One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. Thank you very much indeed, as always, for being here. I know it's another Thursday Arscast, but there's a good reason for that. It's because we have a big game this weekend, and I don't want to start thinking about it just yet. There is so much at stake, so much on the line, that I feel better where it's kind of a little bit there in the distance. Touching distance, it's nearly there, but I don't have to pay too much attention to it yet. We will, of course, but not now. So that's why I thought I would get this out today, because as a kind of distraction from what's coming up on Sunday, the Champions League was pretty entertaining this week. Two semi-finals, Borussia Dortmund against PSG and Bayern Munich against Real Madrid. I had my preferences for each game. They went more or less the way that I would have liked them to go. There was, of course, some late hilarity and some pain for a couple of former Spurs players, one in particular, where the trophylessness that exists within the fiber of his being, probably deep down within his very soul, it followed him from London all the way to Munich. No Bundesliga, no German Cup, and now no Champions League for Harry Kane. And if this was a sitcom, there would be canned laughter all over the place right now. Not only that, though, it's been a very, very quiet week from an Arsenal perspective in terms of Arsenal news. And we don't hear from Mikel Arteta until tomorrow. So talk of Manchester United, thoughts of Manchester United, thoughts of what Manchester City are doing this weekend as they play Fulham, all of that can wait until tomorrow. For now, I think we should talk a bit of Champions League, talk a bit of Arsenal, of course, and I'm delighted to welcome back to the show to do that, Philippe Auclair. Good morning, Philippe.
Good morning, Andrew.
Let us begin with the Champions League semi-finals. We will talk Arsenal, of course, but Champions League semi-finals were this week and last night. Real Madrid went through at the expense of Bayern Munich, which, you know, I'm sorry.
Oh, dear. You didn't say Harry Kane's and Eric Dier's Bayern Munich.
No, I didn't, but that's implied. I think people will understand when I talk about that. And, you know, we were out at the expense of Bayern Munich in the quarterfinals. You know, there are various things that might serve them right that happened over those two games. But Real Madrid, in this competition, have some kind of juju. How do you explain what they do and how they keep doing it, regardless of the team that they have out? Mm. I mean, Carlo Ancelotti obviously is.
Yeah, he's not bad manager.
Not bad, is he? I mean, we'll come to Everton maybe a bit later. I still find it astonishing that he was the manager of Everton not too long ago when Mikel Arteta took charge of Arsenal. But it did look as if Bayern were going to go through, and then two late goals from Joselu, who, if I can just quote Sid Lowe from The Guardian, his description of this player, the former Stoke and Newcastle striker on loan from Espanyol of the second division. Do you ever sometimes feel like, despite spending all your time watching football, talking about football, writing about football, that there are things that make you go, I just don't understand football?
Yeah, I agree entirely. It's chaos, isn't it? Just a word about Joselu. You might not like Real Madrid. I might not like Real Madrid. We might not like Real Madrid for so many reasons, starting with Florentino Perez. Mm. But I think that what Joselu experience last night is that what in the movie theater of our mind, it's the scene that every one of us has played, being a little boy or a little girl, are actually a grown man or a grown woman, everybody wants to have been José Lu for 3 minutes just to know how it feels to score that goal, those goals, I should say.
Mm.
And they're ugly goals as well, which is even better. And so, no, I don't understand. And when it comes to Real Madrid and their extraordinary affinity for this competition, I have to say that I don't want to get all mystical about it, because I genuinely don't think that there is anything like a DNA of a club. I think it's something, an argument which is used far too often to disguise failings and not to talk about the real issues. So we say, oh, that player has got the DNA of the club, or the DNA of the club is that, you know. No, it's not. It's not. Real Madrid, by the way, spent an awful lot of time. If it were really in their DNA, and obviously some of the genes must have gone missing for a large part of the history, because remember how winning the European Cup after, of course, you know, that once they win, they won in the 50s and 60s with the, you know, Gento, Coppa, Puskás, Di Stefano, with all those fabulous players. There was a real, there was a long period of the history when they couldn't win it. So obviously it's not in their DNA. It's just that they're very rich, very powerful. I've got some pretty decent players, and I've had some pretty decent players for a while. I've got one of the all-time great managers. But what is true is that they certainly have, especially after what happened in their last victory, which was crazy, because what's very interesting actually for Real Madrid, sorry, I'm taking attention here, is that their progression in the competition this season is in complete contrast with what they did with Karim Benzema, where it was miracle after miracle after miracle. Here, in some ways, logic has been respected all the way. And if they had gone out, which could have happened, you would have thought, you know what, they went out, but all in all, they were probably the better team. And so it's a completely different set of circumstances. But the fact is that their public knows that they have got this in them. The players somehow are used to winning, and that's a very nice habit to get. And it's, you know, you put that together, and it's not so mystical after all.
Mm.
But it's still not mystical, but still a bit of a mystery. It's, yeah. And I think we should acknowledge that. And I actually tweeted something about it last night, just after the game, when the goal is for Bayern, the equalizing goal is disallowed. And of course, it has to be disallowed because the referee has whistled.
Mm, he was wrong to whistle, and the linesman was probably wrong to put his flag up, but the end result of that move is entirely connected to both of those things. So the goal can't, the goal can't stand.
The goal can't stand. And I'm thinking, well, what if the goal had stood? Because I'm not absolutely sure that Real Madrid would have been able to defend the situation. I don't think that the end result of this move would have been very different from what we saw, but the difference being that the referee would have pointed at the center circle. And then you think, well, in this case, if this had happened, and it could have happened, and maybe it should have happened, how do you talk about the game then?
Mm.
Because everything is, that's the way we talk about football, is always after the event and hindsight.
Sure.
Almost all of the time, especially in encounters of that type, which are decided on, I mean, such fine margins, on margins which don't even exist sometimes. And obviously, because football is chaos. Football is fundamentally organized, or chaos, which some people are better at organizing than others. Ancelotti is very good at that.
Mm.
But it is chaos. And we saw it, and we see it in a competition like the Champions League in the knockout stages, the number of times where situations of that kind happen. To be honest, when we look back, I think we have to have so many regrets not to have beaten Bayern. Because, again, how can it be that our defense, which has been the foundation of Arsenal's success this season, I mean, to a great extent, suddenly had a couple of moments, fleeting moments of absent-mindedness, is call it like that.
Yeah.
Which meant that we conceded two goals at home, which honestly we shouldn't have conceded. And then you can have regrets after the event. But again, it's chaos. It happened that night. Yeah, it happened that night. Did it happen because it was the Champions League and the Premier League? I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't have an answer for that. And so I think we have to accept the fact that we can talk, sense about football, but a lot of what constitutes football and the reasons why we love it is also because it is nonsense.
Yes, I mean, you referenced that game where, you know, last night, obviously, that decision went in Real Madrid's favour. I don't want to delve into conspiracies about anything like that and some of the comments afterwards by the Bayern manager and some of the players about how Real Madrid get all the decisions, whatever. Yeah. But, you know, you think about that game where we could have had a penalty in the in the dying stages of the... I think we should have had a penalty, by the way, in the dying stages of the first leg. And there's a moment where Harry Kane should have been sent off for his elbow on Gabriel. And those decisions went Bayern's way on the night. Mm-hmm. And that can obviously have an impact on the way that things transpire. And I know you sort of poo-pooed the idea of DNA and, you know, this happens because of that or an association. But, you know, it is a bit difficult to look at Bayern not winning a trophy for the first time in about 15 years and link it to Harry Kane's arrival, Harry Kane and Eric Dier bringing their Spursiness from North London all the way to Munich. And the only thing he's going to win this season is a giant cannon for being the Bundesliga's top goal scorer, which I don't know.
The irony of having a cannon being given to you, honestly.
That feels DNA-ish to me, Philippe, you know, not to argue with you too much.
I think that we should not confuse causation with correlation.
Sure, but like we're having fun.
But we can. We can give ourselves the right to do so, to have fun.
For sure. There's enough going on in the world that we should try and take our fun where we can get it. The other game was Borussia Dortmund going through against PSG.
Which was thoroughly enjoyable.
It was also thoroughly enjoyable, I have to say. And, you know, I think we all have our opinion about PSG and the way that they are run and the impact that they've had on the game of football across Europe, which I think has been profoundly negative because of the financial aspect of you know, how they have completely shifted the goalposts and the benchmarks for transfers and wages in a way that, you know, I don't think even Manchester City have done for all the concerns we might have about them and their ownership and everything else. But, you know, when you think about this competition, you think about what the final might look like, you know, if you were to discuss it on paper, I don't think too many people would have said Borussia Dortmund were going to get there. And when you look at the group that they came through, you know, they were beaten by PSG. You look at the quarterfinal where they were beaten by Atletico, or they were, beaten away by Atletico Madrid and came back to win very strongly. And Atletico Madrid are a really tough team to play against, as we know. And they're through to the final, having beaten PSG 1-0 in both of those games. It does give you, in this sort of cynical football world we exist in, a little bit of hope that, you know, not that the underdog or the small guy can come through, because, you know, it's hard to make that case about teams who are in the Champions League anyway. But it is nice to see a team like Borussia Dortmund get through to the final at the expense of a club like PSG.
Yeah, it is lovely. It is lovely. And you could add the fact that in the Bundesliga, there have been no great shakes. They haven't had an awful season, but they're fifth in the league at the moment. Mm. They had some absolutely appalling results during the autumn, in particular, where they lost one or just they were absolutely battered by Bayern in November in Dortmund, 4-0. They were beaten by Leipzig at home. I mean, they had some really poor results, and which was one of the reasons when talking to German friends and people who follow the Bundesliga, and when the groups were drawn, they were saying, oh, Borussia Dortmund doesn't have a chance to do anything. Mm. You should see the state they're in. It's really not good, blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly, when it comes to Europe, they've been able to find their mojo. And I've thoroughly deserved what happened. And obviously, it is chaos. I've lost a number of times I mean, how many times did PSG hit the woodwork?
I don't know. I mean, this is a perfect example of what you're talking about, isn't it? That one of those goes in, you know, you know, you're talking about something completely different and the whole narrative around the game changes and the, you know, Borussia Dortmund's fantastic defensive effort, which I think is, you know,
it was
brilliant. And I really love the fact that, you know, in this day and age where I think a lot of modern football is based around pace, and pure pace is seen as a sort of an acceptable offset to a lack of technical quality in some areas, right? Because you have these young guys who are just blistering, and somebody like Mats Hummels, who not only scored the goal that won the second leg, but defended so brilliantly by virtue of his incredible experience and reading of the game. And again, look, there were these moments where PSG could have done better in front of goal, but I really like that about this game and this tie, that someone like Hummels at 35 years of age can be the difference maker in the modern game.
That's absolutely magnificent. I mean, it's not that they haven't got, you know, quick players, because if you look at Karim Adeyemi, for example, he certainly is not slow. But it's true. It's the virtues of... some people have said it was old-fashioned virtues. I've heard that a lot about the way that Borussia Dortmund beat PSG twice, 1-0 over the two legs. We shouldn't forget that. Mm-hmm. They didn't concede and won both games. And I'm thinking maybe we should rethink the idea of being old-fashioned, because in a way, this kind of attitude is basically a return to collective values, and which, of course, is something to be celebrated.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that it's like, even when people talk about Real Madrid, I think too much is made of Vinicius, for example. I mean, the others are pretty damn good too, and also the work done by Valverde or Tchouameni, for example,
or
in the middle of the park.
Luka Modric last night, if you noticed the incredible sprint and tackle that he made in the Real Madrid box. He got all the way back from taking a corner to chase back and prevent what was going to be a very, very dangerous counterattack before Real Madrid had even scored one of their goals, you know, so unsung heroes.
Absolutely. And you could say that it's, again, a triumph of the collective. And, you know, because that team is very much in Ancelotti's image as well, is that his amazing journey in football. I don't know which words you can use for that, because he's Superman, right?
Mm.
He doesn't look like it. He likes a drink. He likes a little bit of the old salsiccia as well. He's a thoroughly enjoyable company, all this sort of thing. So he's not really Superman, but he is very much a team man. And we talk about return to old-fashioned values. Well, those values have never really gone out of fashion, to be absolutely honest. It's just that our obsession with individual talents, which is, again, we talk about Vinicius, and he had a great game, fine. Or the absurdity of concentrating on Kylian Mbappe over two legs. I mean, I really can't bear that any longer. I've had enough. The way that it was shown by the British broadcaster, TNT, constant. And I know the director was in the Parc des Princes, so maybe they didn't necessarily have the possibility to cut to their own images for that. It was just a general feed, but the talk was all about Mbappe. The slow-mos were all about Mbappe, who had two absolute stinkers, and as if it was all about him. And it's not.
Mm.
It's clearly is not. So what I'm hoping, sorry, this is a very long digression, but that the success of a team like Borussia Dortmund can actually make people think again about the fact what constitutes the route for success of a great football team. Yes, individualities, of course. You know, come on, they've got some good ones at Borussia Dortmund as well. But it's the collective force. And to be honest, we at Arsenal are also a perfect exemplar of that. We've got some brilliant players, wonderful players who, you know, fingers crossed, touch wood and everything, if we do win that big trophy, whatever it is, in the next couple of years, these players, they will have their faces and their names on the outside of the stadium,
mm-hmm.
because that's how strong a relationship we're building with them. But the major, the principal value of that Arsenal team, and one of the reasons why we are so connected to it, is precisely because we feel it is a team, and that it's based on these same old-fashioned values, and they're not old-fashioned at all. They're actually the bedrock of success.
Yeah.
And you can add to that individual talent, data analysis, intelligent recruitment, everything you can think of, preparation of set plays, of course, in our case. But fundamentally, it's because everybody fights for each other. And yeah. I know it sounds a bit like a cliche, but it's a kind of obvious truism that it is not old-fashioned to put forward right now because of the society we live in, which is all about individuality, individualism, be yourself. You're amazing. No, you're not. actually, you're not amazing at all, but you could do amazing things with other people.
Sure.
And to see a team like Borussia Dortmund, where they were so obviously fighting for each other in that way, and you know, they've been so, I mean, some of the Niklas Füllkrug, I mean, what a story. Actually, you could say this is a story of Füllkrug and Joselu.
Yeah, it's amazing.
If you look at the trajectory of those two guys in football, you think, no way. And Füllkrug is not that quick. He's not that slow, but he's not that quick either.
Mm. I was going to ask you a little bit about Mbappe, and you sound like you don't really want to focus too much on him, but I'm just curious as to what, you know, how you view his time at PSG in the context of what maybe PSG were trying to do. You know, they bought Neymar, they bought Messi, they had Mbappe. The goal, the project, if, you know, such a thing existed in a coherent way at that club, was to win the Champions League. And once again, they failed in that. And it looks like he's going to leave. It looks like he'll go in the summer. He'll be at Real Madrid by the looks of it. And God almighty, you know, who knows what they'll do in the Champions League when they've got a guy like that to add to all the other incredible talent that they have with that collective element that you're talking about. But, you know, as a player who's turning 26 now in December, I think it is, how do you view his years at PSG? You know, in an objective way, I guess, as a Frenchman and as somebody who knows and understands his talent and that league and you know, everything else that's been going on around him in these last sort of 4 or 5 years.
Well, there are many ways to look at it. One of them would be, if you look at the stats and everything, he's done what he was supposed to do. He has scored and assisted a crazy number of goals. He's often been brilliant. He's scored some fabulous goals. He's been also sometimes very, very bad or mediocre. But it's in complete contrast with Mbappe we know from the French national team, where he's in a very different context and where he has been an absolutely top player for France over the same period. With PSG, to be honest, it's a bit of a mess. I think that what the titles he's won there don't really matter. Like, they don't really matter. That all the circus around him and his relationship with the club, his relationship with other superstars, has been one of the most boring stories ever. I think it would be very good for him to leave Paris Saint-Germain. And it might be very good for Paris Saint-Germain for Mbappé not to be there any longer. It was, as you said, it was a project, not a career. And the project was to move from Monaco. I mean, everybody knew from the age of 12 that he would be playing for one of the top clubs in Europe, in the world. It was clear in everybody's mind. If you talk to people who knew him when he was a kid, and such is his talent. And the Paris Saint-Germain thing and the whole nonsense about Macron, the president of the French Republic, you know, moving in to try and give his pennyworth of salt on the question and encouraging him to stay in France and him becoming the kind of flag bearer of Ligue 1, a competition in which PSG only encounters serious opposition, I would say, one game out of five. So this is not how he's going to progress. This is why what is achieved, and he has achieved a few things statistically and a few titles, really doesn't really matter.
Mm.
It doesn't matter. If he had, you know, Joselu and Füllkrug have had a better season than Kylian Mbappé. Now, we can say it now. But still, I mean, I'm a bit amazed. You know, he's been awful over the past few weeks and even past few months. I don't know if it's the consequence of the prospect of finally going to Real Madrid, that he's had enough, that he doesn't quite fit in with what Luis Enrique is trying to do with PSG, which is to create a team which is very much about the collective, that's for sure.
Mm.
But he's been very poor. He's trying too much. He's trying too hard. He wants to be the center of attention all the time. He's been very petulant on the pitch, which is, you know, surprising for somebody who is so smart, so intelligent, so composed. I think it's just... Yeah, get out, Kylian. Go somewhere else.
Yeah.
What will he do in a team where there's also Rodrigo and Vinicius up front? I'm very interested to see that. And because who's the biggest star of the lot? People will say Mbappé at the moment, but on the strength of that this season, it's Vinicius, right?
I mean, it's going to be fascinating to see where he fits and where exactly they're going to play him. And
because Vinicius plays on the left as well.
Yeah, but I mean, Mbappe down the middle sounds pretty pretty tempting to me.
Mm-hmm. We shall see. It will be interesting. But I'm, as you can hear, I think that the way that everything has been about him in France, I think that there was a stat I saw the other day that 60% of the front pages devoted to football in L'Equipe had a photograph of Mbappé in them.
Wow.
It's insane.
That's ridiculous spotlight to exist under, isn't it? Even if, you know, as a high profile, yeah.
And it's about him, and it's to the point it becomes ridiculous. Like, some journalists will go to the games almost in the hope he's going to have a stinker so that they can give him 3 out of 10. It's almost like it's either 9 out of 10 or zero.
Yeah.
And it's not a good environment for him any longer. And Madrid probably will be, a much more competitive environment. And Real Madrid does have to play more than 5 games a season to win the La Liga.
Mm.
It would be very good. But let's see what he does in Germany at the Euro, because he's had his best moments under a French shirt, and without a doubt.
Yeah, just for the record, 306 games for PSG, 255 goals, 108 assists, which is, you know, absurd, even taking into account, as you alluded to, you know, some of the games in the league, in Liga, maybe not as competitive as he might face elsewhere. I want to move back to Arsenal, and you talk about the collective, and you talk about how that has been the foundation of what Arsenal have done and built and how we've progressed, and I fully agree with that, but I do want to talk to you about some individual players, one of whom I, you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I feel like from what I read, you know, when his name is mentioned in relation to the France national team, whether it's from Didier Deschamps or whether it's from certain French pundits, that the perception of William Saliba among Arsenal fans is very different from the perception of William Saliba among, you know, certain pundits or media in France, that they don't seem to rate him as highly as we do over here. And I don't think it's coincidence in any way, and I'm not saying it's just down to him. I think his partnership with Gabriel is brilliant, and I could go through this Arsenal team and talk about relationships and people and players who've been brilliant this season, but I also don't think it is a coincidence that we are heading into the penultimate weekend of the Premier League season and Arsenal are still in the title race and still have a chance of winning the Premier League, albeit dependent on somebody doing something against Manchester United, which, you know, Fulham flying kites at the training ground, I'm not 100% sure that's the best preparation for a game against Man City, but that could be just me. I could be wrong here. But you know, as somebody who watches Saliba week in, week out for Arsenal, are you a little surprised about the sort of disparity in the view of the quality of this player?
Yes, I am. And I find it almost incomprehensible. But this being said, remember something which I think I've already mentioned to you, is that Didier Deschamps has never been to a Premier League match since he left England himself when he was playing for Chelsea. He doesn't go to Premier League games. I've never seen his right-hand guy either at a Premier League game. So all the reports they will get will be from scouts sent by the French FA. That's already quite amazing, isn't it, when you think about it? Because he's not the only French player who actually plays in England, is he?
No.
There are fewer than there used to be, but there are still a few of those. Anyway, so that's the first thing. The second thing is that some of the choices of Didier Deschamps have been bizarre when thinking that William Saliba was available. And, of course, that he prefers perhaps centre-backs who are even more imposing physically than William Saliba. But even though Saliba is very imposing physically, but so he will go for Ibrahima Konate or Dayot Upamecano, for example. But the extraordinary thing is that when he doesn't have his first-choice defence together, he would also ask Benjamin Pavard to play in central defence. One of the Hernandez brothers. I mean, they're good footballers, but none of them is in the same category as Saliba. And it's not just us Arsenal fans who say that. I think any people who follow the Premier League will tell you that this season he's been the best centre-back in the league. And I don't think that anybody would disagree with that. Van Dijk was very good for a part of the season, but has had a few problematic weeks, shall we say. Ruben Dias is not quite at the same level. There's a lot of chopping and changing. John Stones has been injured. You look at all the possible candidates, and he's the obvious choice for, you know, centre-back of the season. And for us, it's obvious because he's got it all. He's also got the speed. He's speedy enough to use that for recovery. Mm-hmm. His positioning is superb. He barely ever commits fouls, which one-to-one is imperious. You look at all these things, and he can play from the back, which is the thing that the French national team is not necessarily the best at. And you're thinking, well, come on, TJ, wake up. You've got this guy. Here's your solution. Now, the thing is that Saliba needs a Gabriel, right?
Mm.
And who would be Gabriel to Saliba, who would be also have, you know, left-footed, I'm not quite sure. I very much rate Ibrahima Konate myself, but he tends to play on the same side, so I don't know. But there is a definite discrepancy between the way we perceive him to be, which I think is correct, and the way that he's talked about in France, and especially the way he's talked about by the people who really matter, like Didier Deschamps, who's made some comments about him, which, to be honest, were on the verge of public criticism. I mean, that was a while ago, but he did that as if he didn't quite rate him, which is astonishing. Is it because his career trajectory has been a bit complicated, signing from Saint-Etienne to Arsenal, then going back to Saint-Etienne as a loanee, then going to Nice, then going to Marseille? Yeah, but he's been great in all of those clubs.
Yeah.
And now he's great in a club that is fighting against Manchester City for the Premier League title and was a whisker away of qualifying for the semi-finals of the Champions League. I mean, there is something I don't quite understand, I must say.
Deschamps said back in March, he does things I don't like.
Like, what, Didier?
Well, that was my question. Like, what about his game is it that you don't like? Is it the positioning? Is it the reading of the game? Is it the aerial prowess? Is it the ability on the ball? Is it the ability to carry the ball forward? Is it the fact that, you know, there was a moment in the there was a moment in the North London Derby where Son had a chance and he got between the two Arsenal central defenders and he whacked it over the bar. But what was so astonishing about that chance was that I can't remember the last time that happened, where a ball went between the two Arsenal central defenders and the opposition were clear in on goal. And the reason that it sticks in my mind is because I've spent fucking 5 years previous to that watching that happen over and over and over again and going, what the fuck is going on? Why can't these guys sort this? This is basic stuff. So I'm sort of staggered at the idea that, you know, every defender and every player makes a little mistake here and there, or, you know, a pass that doesn't quite go where it goes. But it's, you know, is there a frequency to that with Saliba? No. Do they stand out because they're so rare? Yes. I do not get it. I heard William Gallas say something about it as well. I'm like, what are you watching? What are these guys actually watching, or are they watching, or are they simply, you know, making their making these statements based on their own perception rather than the reality of what they're seeing, whether they're at a game or watching it on TV?
I think perhaps, strangely enough, is the impression of calm that he gives on the pitch, which might be a problem with them, because it can look that he's too relaxed and not focusing enough. Mm. When it's the complete opposite, it's just a player who exudes class.
Yeah,
and if you think of William Gallas, I mean, Gallas was a very good central defender, but he was not exactly known for his calm. He was not exactly known for his ability to play from the back. And I think maybe one of the things which Didier Deschamps doesn't like about William Saliba, being risk-averse as he is the fact that Saliba trusts himself in a tight situation, close to his goal line, to get the ball out in a clean fashion and to find one of his teammates, which means taking a few risks from time to time. Attempting a dribble by his own corner flag, and we've seen that so many times, and then finding a pass. And I think Deschamps, in his mind, this is complete anathema. We can't have that. His French team doesn't play very well from the back at all. If you look at it, the way that the France plays through the lines is relying on players like Tchouaméni, for example, who has got superb vision. What a player he is, to go through the lines. But the central defenders, you're not going to ask Hernandez or Konate maybe a little bit, or Upamecano to do this kind of building from the back. You're not going to do that. This is not their game. Mm. And Saliba, it is his game. And maybe that's something that Didier Deschamps doesn't want to happen.
Yeah, he's maybe playing the way he's being asked to play at Arsenal, which is at odds with what Deschamps wants. Anyway, it's a mystery to me.
And we've lost Raphael Varane, I mean, as well, who was perhaps of all the central defenders the one who was the closest in terms of style of play and elegance. But Varane has been gone for a while, and we miss him, to be absolutely honest. And Saliba would be an obvious replacement, almost like for like, but I think even better.
Yeah,
which is saying something.
Let's talk Kai Havertz. And he was named Arsenal's Player of the Month. We've had these questions over the last while about, you know, who is the player who might, you know, in a title push, just step up and produce what you don't necessarily expect that player to produce. And, you know, you think of Freddie Ljungberg when he scored all those goals on the run into the title that year. And it strikes me that Kai Havertz is probably that. For this season, whether it happens or not, whether we win the title or not, that second half of the season contribution from him has been extremely important, not just in terms of the end product, but also the structure of the team. And I think it's really interesting to think about, you know, how a manager at the start of the season will sit down and strategize. And I think we've we've seen in the last few years that there has been a really coherent strategy at Arsenal in terms of recruitment, the types of players, the you know, the profile of the players, where they're going to play on the pitch, all of that. And here we are towards the end of the season with a player who I think was earmarked for a very different role when he was signed, but has flourished in a different position. And as a manager, you have to be fluid enough or flexible enough to lean into what a player is doing on the pitch and perhaps, you know, change different parts of your team in order to accommodate that. And you know, I think you could probably draw a through line between Havertz and his impact up front and also Declan Rice and his impact as a number eight, whereas I think Rice was brought in to be a number six, Havertz was brought in to be the number eight, and they both shifted a couple of positions forward or a couple of a bit further forward in the team to tremendous effect. And now the job maybe for Mikel Arteta is to think about a different way of structuring his team from the one he probably had at the start of the season.
I'm very happy that and glad that you've tried to define what Kai Havertz's position was in the team, because as to me, I'm unable to actually call him anything because I don't know. I genuinely don't know. He's a nominal number nine.
Box-to-box centre forward. If we just invented a new position.
Yeah. Well, his runs are very unusual. His runs from the left are very unusual. For a centre-forward. I mean, he's absolutely magnificent with his back to goal as header of the ball. I mean, that is also, it's made such a huge difference to the team as a whole that you know you have this option, and which Raya, by the way, is using a lot and rather well.
Yeah.
But he's not an all... I mean, it's always been Kai Havertz's problem that everybody has known for a very long time in Germany that he was, you know, what they call a generational player. It's just a matter of how do you use this potential, because he's very tall, he's strong, he's quick, technically very adept, both feet, superb header of the ball, as I already said. He's got a bit of the devil in him as well, which is quite nice from time to time. But where do you play him? And okay, we play him as a number nine, but we don't play him as a number nine, if you see what I mean. I mean, he's, which is great, which means that there is a tactical flexibility about that team, despite the fact that we have more or less the same team every single game. And we think, okay, Saka on the right, Leo on the left, and if it's not Leo, it's Gabi, Rice, Partey, maybe Jorginho, blah, 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 blah. We know what it's going to be like, but the difference is that when we see the way we play when we are in action, there's something really unpredictable about him, Kai Havertz. His placement, his movement, the angles that he chooses. And it's a role that he's never really had. It's a hybrid role. As you say, it's a box-to-box number nine, which is also an attacking midfielder. And very interesting, I was looking through his stats, you know, he had this fabulous season with Bayer Leverkusen back in 2018, 2019, when he was a baby. And he scored, 20 goals in total for Bayer Leverkusen that year, which is, you know, pretty prodigious, especially since when you look at the positioning that he had at the time, he was an attacking midfielder or sometimes even deployed as a true number eight, as a central midfielder. And he still scored all those goals. And he never played once as a center forward. Once, not once. And then here, and for years, people have been tearing their hair out, wondering, well, where do we play him? But, you know, talk to people who follow Chelsea, they will tell you that they all knew that he had the qualities, but we didn't know how to make the best of him. And now it seems it's happened. It seems it's happened. But it does help when you've got players like Martin Odegaard who can play with you and you can play off. It does help when you've got players like that, or Declan Rice, or even I would say Jorginho, or everybody else for that matter, because I love them all.
I mean, I think that's true. I also think there's a really good example here of how a player can take time to fit into a club. And I remember when he was having those early struggles and when he was settling into the team, you could see a player that was completely devoid of confidence in comparison to the one that we have now. You know, even the way, you know, we've talked about this so many times down the years. How quickly do you pass the ball? How hard do you hit the ball when you're making a pass? And simple things like that were, you know, missing from his game. And there's a decisiveness to the way that he plays. And look, I don't want to make spurious comparisons in any way, but there have been down the years at Arsenal examples of players, big players with big talent, who have taken a long, not maybe a long time, but have taken time to settle in. And this, again, is not to make direct comparisons, but, you know, Dennis Bergkamp being written off as a flop by, I think it was Stuart Pearce, actually, in one of the newspapers, because he didn't score for the first 6-7 games when he came to Arsenal. Thierry Henry signed as a forward. It took him a while to get off the mark. The famous example, and I think it is maybe a little bit overblown at times, is Robert Pires, who...
Yeah.
Who it did take him a little bit of time to get used to English football because it was so different from what he was used to. But at the same time, I think the idea that Pires had a terrible first season at Arsenal is overblown. It took him a while to get going, but when he did, you could see that there was an amazing player in there. And I think there's something similar to this with Havertz in that he had this Premier League experience, but his experience at a basket case club, I should say, like Chelsea, obviously had an impact on his confidence. He probably wasn't completely blind to the reaction to his signing. And here we are down the line, and this is a guy who looks completely and utterly settled at Arsenal, completely and utterly at home with what Mikel Arteta wants from him and is delivering. And, you know, patience is not always a virtue that's... one with high regard, rather, among football fans, but it does pay off from time to time.
Yeah, it does. I was trying to think of other players who had similar tough period to start with.
Koscielny?
Tough-ish.
Maybe?
Tough. Who? Sorry?
Laurent Koscielny, maybe?
Yes, maybe, yeah. Maybe. In a very different kind of team, obviously.
Yeah.
Alexander Hleb? Maybe yes, maybe not. It's hard to tell, but it's quite logical, isn't it, that you would take some time to fit in
sure.
a system. And I don't know really what to add to what you said, because I agree with absolutely everything you've said, which is, I don't know if it's a good or a bad sign, I think one of the main things that, you know, Mikel Arteta has achieved is to make footballers into who they already were but didn't know.
That's quite Wenger-esque, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, actually.
In its way. When you think about the players that he signed and repurposed and you know, got things out of them that they didn't think they were capable of. Laurent, for example, was a great example of, you know, brought in as a midfielder, and he's told you're playing right back, and he's like, why? Yeah. And then, you know, oh, that's
okay. Osaka is only probably the best right winger on the planet. Well, certainly is for me. You know, never played in that position up until 2 or 3 years ago, ever. Leo Trossard. Who has one of the other players, by the way. You talk about those players like Freddy Ljungberg, who have got this huge impact on the end of a season. I mean, Trossard, who cost us very little, has been one of those players. And scoring super important goals on a number of occasions. And again, playing on the left-hand side, which is not exactly the positioning that you would have associated him with when he was at Brighton. He makes players realize that actually this is where you're going to be the best. But it works both ways, because the players are also are giving back so much in terms of their own commitment and the fact that nobody is complaining about it. you know. And I was saying, well, my natural position, what you hear Phil Foden saying, my natural position is that of an attacking or number 10 or whatever. And he said, okay, fine, all right. You don't hear that. You don't hear Bukayo Saka talk like that. As to Kai Havertz, I think he plays in the Kai Havertz role.
Yeah.
You know, you have to think of that. There's a Makelele role, there's the Kai Havertz role. You know, I'm a target man. I'm a defender. I'm a winger. I'm the guy who suddenly will come in the box at the last minute. Alan Ljungberg, you know.
Yeah.
But I can play on the wing as well, and I can play as a central mid. Well, my goodness, it's remarkable how it's all falling together. In the right places, in the right slots.
Yeah, Martin Odegaard is another player whose potential was obvious to everybody, but has been unlocked at Arsenal. I enjoyed Arteta talking about him this week in the context of one of his own favourite players. Arteta said one of his favourites was Michael Laudrup, who was an incredible talent. He said he sees similarities between Odegaard and Laudrup, which is, you know, high praise indeed for. For those of us fortunate enough to have seen Michael Laudrup, he was just an amazing footballer, and to compare Odegaard to him is really something.
Yeah, and talk about late developers, eh?
Yeah,
as well. I mean, the one name that comes to my mind immediately is of Dennis Bergkamp, because not because they're so similar, it's just that he does things that only Dennis Bergkamp could see, could have seen, and could have executed. That there are, each game, even when he's not absolutely on top, and he's on top at the moment, there are always four, five, six times when you basically think, did I just see what I just saw?
Yeah.
How did he see that pass? This thing that he manages to turn on the sixpence from this, exactly not moving one inch in terms of his positioning. If you put a GPS on Martin Odegaard, there are moments where he doesn't move. He just spins on left, right, left, right. And you see the guys around him. There's about four footballers who are trying to nick the ball off him. And they all go left, right, left, right. They don't know what to do. And miraculously, the ball ends up in the feet of an Arsenal teammate. How many players can do that? Dennis could do it. He can do it. Yeah. Some of the passes are pure Dennis as well. I say it's, again, this ability to see things that we cannot see ourselves, and which make an awful lot of sense after the event. So when you say,
sure.
Yes, of course, that was the pass. That was the pass. That was the thing to do. Yeah, but he could see that before the ball actually touched his feet, which is what Dennis could do. So that when the ball was traveling to him, he knew what he was going to do. And he knew how he would execute it, which is why I think of Dennis more than any other player when I think of Martin Odegaard. And also for the aesthetic value, I think that he's the kind of player, he makes you purr, he makes your hair stand on end, and not by, you know, putting screamers in the top corner, which is great, but his art is much subtler than that and much more beautiful for me.
Yeah.
And at the same time, he's the guy who in the 90th minute will still be pressing from the top and fighting like mad, whatever the scoreline is. I mean, we're blessed to have a Martin Odegaard at Arsenal.
That's very true. I think the Bergkamp comparison is a really interesting one as well. You know, you're talking about that, and I thought immediately of the goal he created for Trossard in the game against Porto. That was 100% pure Bergkamp, you know, that kind of movement and that kind of vision. I do want to ask you, you know, we're heading towards the end, so I don't want to keep you too much longer, but, you know, we are going into the penultimate weekend of the season, and we're in an amazing position. It's possible that we could win the league. It's not a certainty by any means. There are things that we need to do, and there are things that we need other people to do, but... You know, football is full of surprises and full of miracles, and we'll keep everything crossed for that. But just sort of in broad terms, you know, how do you view this season as one of growth and progress for Arsenal? And is it one where, regardless of how it ends up, regardless of whether we win the league or not, you know, do you see the potential for more to come from this team and this manager and what they can produce and ultimately hopefully get those big prizes under our belts?
I think it's a 9 out of 10 season, and it will be a 10 out of 10 if our friends from up the road do what they should be doing on the 14th, which is going to be a very strange experience for many people, shall I say.
Yeah.
I've got Spurs friends, as I'm sure you have, and they are really conflicted. They are really, really conflicted about what is going to happen. But yeah, 9 out of 10, and for so many reasons. Despite a few bumps in the road, you know, of course the game against Aston Villa, but you know, you've got to admit that Aston Villa played a truly exceptional game that day, defensively and offensively. Is there anything you can reproach the players? Absolutely nothing. Mm. And also, I'm certainly not one of these people who thinks that your team should win every single game, because it's not going to happen unless you're Manchester City, and we know why they do that, and which is why we don't like them. And which is why it would be super sweet, sure. I have to say. But yes, no, this team has achieved everything. I think it has played the most beautiful football that we've seen Arsenal play since, I would say, the 2007-2008 team of Cesc and Alex Leb, you know, beat Milan, I mean, which was playing some absolutely magnificent football. But I think it certainly played the best football, most beautiful football in the country, that, without a doubt. Certainly since the 1st of January, because we shouldn't forget that we had a really, really complicated start to the season. You will remember, you know, we talked about it, and we were grinding out results. We were not as convincing as we'd been the season before. We were not as fluent and fluid as we'd been before. And then suddenly something, you know, it was progressive, and then we hit our stride and then produced some football, which I think is worthy of the best football we saw Wenger teams play in Highbury. And for that, also, it's a 9 out of 10. Can they go beyond what they will achieve? Yes, I think they can. The fact of being, we know we'll be in the Champions League, and I think that people will be really scared of us next season in the Champions League. What happened against Bayern will help. Domestically speaking, in fairness, if it were not for Manchester City, we'd have sewn up the title, you know, weeks ago.
By now,
That's the thing. That's the thing. There is this always this disbalance between City and the others, and some of this disbalance is due, and let's acknowledge it, to the exceptional talent of their manager, very sound recruitment policy, and some bloody good players. These are not the only reasons, which is why it's a problematic success. But we have to acknowledge that, and that they have made the extraordinary ordinary, and then we have to be able to beat those guys. We've got to also make the extraordinary ordinary, but that's not the way we are. We are not as perfect an organization. We're not as perfect a club, a team, as, you know, this strange animal at the Etihad, which... is strange. Yeah, it's strange in so many ways, because it leaves me totally cold.
Yeah.
And I think it leaves most people totally cold, even though everybody keeps harping about how beautiful their game is. It's not, actually. I don't agree with them at all. I think it's a soulless game. But then you go, anyway, that's a different conversation to have another time. But we are not like that. We are a very soulful team. And I love that about it.
Yeah.
And there is something prodigiously exciting about it. And it's a very young team. Obviously, we've sorted out the recruitment side of things. If you look at the players we've signed, my goodness, it's like hit, hit, hit. You know, Trossard, Jorginho, whom I love, Havertz, Rice, obviously, we could speak for hours about Declan Rice. The recruitment has been absolutely terrific. We don't seem to have... I was looking at the time that the players have got left on their contracts. We are no longer in the situation where you start fretting because one of your key players only has a year and a half or two years left. No. Everything's been sorted. So every reason to feel super confident. We've got a manager whom the players trust and who has built a very special connection with us fans as well. So I cannot see any other reason, any reason not to be, first of all, happy, grateful, and confident.
Well, let's hope that whatever happens between now and the end of the season, the success is with us and it's not a problematic success. I really love that turn of phrase. Because I you know, we've all waited so long. It would be amazing to do it, even if we are, as I said, a bit dependent on Fulham and Spurs and West Ham to do something. But, you know, let's see and let's hope we can do what we need to do in our two games. And either way, though, it's a fun team and it's a fun time to be an Arsenal fan.
That's the most important thing. Have fun.
All right. We better leave it there. As ever, Philippe, a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Andrew.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Thank you very much indeed to Philippe. You can find him on Twitter. He is at Philippe Auclair, at Philippe Auclair. So that is just about that for today's show. We will turn attention to our game against Manchester United, taking place on Sunday afternoon. We're away at Old Trafford. We will talk about that in much more detail in our Premier League preview podcast, which is exclusive for our Patreon members. If you'd like to get on board, you get a preview podcast, you get our Premier League review podcast called The 30, ad-free Arscasts and Arscast Extras, Discord chat, and years of content in the archives that you get instant access to if you would like to sign up. It is patreon.com/arsblog. The cost is $6. There are taxes depending on where you are in the world. Those things are out of our hands. But even so, it's good value. You don't get much for $6 these days. Can't even buy a $5 bill with $6. That's how bad things have got. So patreon.com/arsblog if you'd like to join us for that. If you don't, no worries. Thank you so much, as always, for being here today. We will have an Arscast Extra for you a little bit earlier this week. We will be recording on Sunday evening, not long after the game. So we will have that for you a bit later on Sunday evening. So join myself and James for that. For now, take it easy, folks, and we will catch you on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye.
Welcome back to Sky Sports News. The football season is over. The European Championships are on the horizon. But before the teams meet for their training camp, they've been given some time off by England manager Gareth Southgate. We hear that England captain Harry Kane has gone on holidays to the Canary Islands after a season in which he scored a multitude of goals, but once again ended up without a single trophy to his name. Also heading away on holidays, we're getting some breaking news here in the Sky Sports Centre. We're being told that the Canary Islands is currently undergoing the biggest volcanic eruption since Krakatoa in 1883. Nobody understands how this could have happened. It's almost as if somebody is cursed or something. We will keep you up to date with developments as and when we have them. Now though, on Sky Sports News, Unai Emery makes that zombie sound he does.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.